Today, will life return to normal with Boris Johnson's roadmap? Here we go again.
Good evening, and thank you very much for joining us.
On Monday, the Prime Minister laid out how the government is going to lift the restrictions that we are all living under. Boris Johnson has a roadmap, a four-stage plan that starts with the reopening of schools and could end with the return of nightclubs on the 21st of June, a prospect that sent social media into a frenzy.
Leading us to a spring and a summer, which I think will be seasons of hope, looking and feeling incomparably better for us all, and from which we will not go back.
But this plan has been met with dismay from some within his party.
There's going to be a huge amount of economic hurt and health consequences flowing from that, and we're going to be picking up the pieces for years to come.
And concern from businesses who won't be able to reopen until April at the earliest.
Frankly, we will not make money. We will not be viable trading from pub gardens. You know, it'll be nice for some customers to come and have a drink, and I'm sure we'll give them a good experience where we can, but many pubs will not be able to open. They don't have outdoor space. They don't have gardens.
Now many are asking why things can't reopen more quickly. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the science behind England's COVID exit plan. Nicola Davis, you're The Guardian's science correspondent, and you've been covering the Prime Minister's roadmap announcement this week. It begins with schools opening on the 8th of March, and then we'll be able to see up to five people outdoors from the end of next month. This might all feel a bit slow for some people. Why is the government being cautious?
It might seem a bit slow, I can understand that. And I think for a lot of people it will seem slow because we've heard a lot about the vaccines and how good the COVID vaccines are. So I think there is this quite natural sort of feeling of, well, can't we go a bit faster? You know, can't we get back to normal a bit faster? But there's several reasons why it's important to take things slowly and cautiously. The first thing, and possibly sort of overarching thing, is that everyone wants this to be the last time we have a lockdown. So that's sort of the sort of overarching theme. I mean, if you then look at why do we need to go at this particular pace? Well, the scientists who are advising the government, this is the SAGE group of experts, they've basically said, well, look, every time you make some sort of change, some kind of policy change, and then that changes people's behaviours, it takes time for the impact of that change to be seen in the data. So in the cases, in the hospitalisations, and in the deaths. So what they've done is they've said, well, we're going to put a five-week gap between steps, and that will give us time to see the effect and see, okay, if we do this, what's the knock-on effect? If you do everything in one go and then suddenly infections take off, it's very, very hard to know which change in policy had what size effect. So this is very much about going kind of baby steps. So make a change, wait and see, make a change, wait and see.
And the government are going to apply four tests as they make decisions on opening up, aren't they? These are whether the vaccine programme is continuing successfully, how effective the vaccines actually are, the infection rate and risk posed by new variants.
Yes, you're right. There are these so-called four tests. This sort of ties into what the scientists have said, which is we need to be guided by the data, not dates. I mean, one issue that some scientists have raised is that these four tests are quite vague, but nonetheless, the idea is that you do have these sort of checkpoints or these sort of pauses that you have to make to see, is it appropriate to keep going? Are there issues that need to be handled? Do we need to slow down even?
I mean, some, Nicola, might feel that this is too slow, but others are worried that the reopening of schools on March the 8th is happening too fast. I mean, England is sending all pupils back at the same time, while Wales and Scotland have already begun phased returns this week. What is the science behind the decision to send all students back at once?
there are good reasons for wanting to get children back to schools as a kind of general idea here. I mean, we know that homeschooling is very, very difficult for families. There are concerns about the impact it will have on children's education. There are concerns about the impact on children's mental health, not being out there socialising, not mixing with their friends, not being in an educational setting in the same way as they have been. In terms of what happens when you send children back to school, the data isn't very clear, so it's not entirely clear what impact that has on transmission in the community or infections among children. There's also the issue that younger children seem to be less susceptible to coronavirus than older children. It's almost like a kind of bit of a sliding scale there. So you can't talk about children as sort of one entity. There are differences there depending upon their age. But overall, there is a general consensus, it seems, that reopening schools will increase the R number a bit. In England, they've decided to reintroduce schools, both primary and secondary, and open them up from the 8th of March. There's also increased testing of secondary school students and mask wearing of secondary school students.
Okay, so testing and mask wearing for older children, but not for primary age pupils. What else are schools having to think about before they reopen?
When it comes to making schools a safe environment, you have to think about things like ventilation as well, also spacing of students in the classroom and so on. So there's lots of different measures which schools will be considering and which have been considering for a long time in order to make sure that schools are safe. Now, in terms of the schools going back, it's important to say that if schools reopening does increase R, it's not entirely clear why that is. For example, it might not be down to children mixing in the classrooms. It might be linked to other effects. For example, increased mixing when parents are dropping off the kids at school, or the fact that if you've got children at school, parents might find it easier to go back to the workplace and then you've got extra contact there. So schools reopening, it has effects on contact and transmission beyond what's happening just in the classroom. And unpicking those factors is very, very difficult.
The other thing that will change on the 8th of March is that we will now all be able to meet someone outside for a coffee. And that's going to be expanded to 5 other people from different households a few weeks later. Why are we able to start doing this?
Again, I think that when we talk about unlocking the country, scientists and politicians have been looking at what do people need most first. You know, there is a recognition that a lot of us have been living with very, very little social contact for a very, very long time. And that, again, has large and detrimental impacts on health and well-being. So I think that's one of the reasons why allowing people just that little bit more socialising, that little bit more social contact is a priority.
At the end of March, the stay-at-home rule also ends, but people are still being encouraged to stay local. What does that really mean?
I think the idea is not to move sort of around the country to a great degree. And the reason for that would be that the situation is not the same across the country. You do have variations in infection rates. And what you don't want is somebody taking infections from an area where you've got very high prevalence and seeding them in areas where you actually have very low levels of coronavirus.
Right, so that's what's happening in March, but no mention of businesses opening in stage one. They'll have to wait until at least April the 12th when non-essential retail can open. We can maybe all get a haircut, which I think a lot of people are thinking about, and even have a drink outside at a pub. What will the decision to allow these things to happen be based on?
It will depend how well the first step of unlocking has gone. In terms of things like non-essential retail, so popping to the shops, Sage says that retail has, you know, a sort of low impact on transmission. But nonetheless, you know, it could increase transmission. So you have to stagger your steps here. I'm not an economist. I'm not a business reporter. But I think it seems clear that, you know, going back into lockdown again would be very, very harmful for businesses. So if we can unlock slowly, but hopefully not have to take such harsh measures again, that's got to be a good thing.
So that's businesses in April. And then in May and June, we've been given a huge list of very exciting things that might happen, up to 30 people could meet outside. Up to 10,000 people could go to a football game. Even nightclubs may be opening by June the 21st. All of this feels like a huge leap, though, from where we are now.
My view would be to look at them as sort of a kind of very loose timescale for the kind of order in which things might be unlocked. But I mean, I think the further away or the further into the future you go, the more uncertainty there is about whether that will happen at that point in time.
I was sort of thinking of it, Nicola, like a horoscope. You know, when you read a quick horoscope and you don't really, you take the sentiment of it, but you don't really believe those things are maybe going to happen when they say they will.
Well, I have to say as a science correspondent, I wouldn't read a horoscope at all.
That's where you and I are very different.
But I think that to pin your hopes on getting back into the club by June the 21st is probably misguided.
In order for us to have any hope of getting into a club at all, the government are applying those four tests we talked about earlier. But they're also trying to answer some big questions about lifting restrictions through a series of reviews. What are they?
There are lots of things that are being looked at whilst this unlocking process is going ahead. So these cover whether something called COVID status certificates might be useful. So this is essentially some kind of document which shows that people have had a vaccine, and could that be useful in helping to reopen the economy or reducing restrictions on contact if you've got this document. There's also an events research programme. So this is going to be looking at the effects of having larger crowds or reducing social distancing and what impact that has. And then there's also a review going on from the Department of Transport about how to allow more inbound and outbound travel into the country. And that's really because we've got these concerns about new variants of COVID. And then the other review is, again, on social distancing. So things like the 1 meter plus rule, masks, working from home, those sorts of things.
You mentioned social distancing. Are we going to have to continue doing this for months to come?
I mean, I think that there are certain things that we need to do. So there's been a lot of modelling done to inform the government's decision about what to do next. And most of those models, which were run by researchers in different groups, they sort of assume a certain level of what we call baseline NPIs. And this is non-pharmaceutical interventions and things that basically we need to stay in place. So we're talking about things like mask wearing, and making sure that we have a test, trace and isolate system. These sorts of interventions will remain important.
And you mentioned the review into inbound and outbound travel. We just heard yesterday from some areas of the travel industry that after the Prime Minister's announcement, there was a huge peak in interest in booking foreign holidays. EasyJet reported a 337% surge in flight bookings to places like Spain and Crete. Should people be booking a holiday now?
What people should do is not really for me to say, but I would point out just that right now you can't go on holiday anywhere. And whether you'll be able to go on holiday anywhere by the summer will depend upon an awful lot of things going right and policy changes which have not yet been made. So I would say simply to make sure you've got some good travel insurance.
And one of the reasons the government is being very cautious about travel is because it can lead to the spread of variants, which we now know can undermine some of the vaccines that we're already using.
So there is some concern from laboratory-based studies and also from some clinical trials that some of the vaccines might be less effective against some variants. And that, of course, is a concern if we're pinning all of our hopes on vaccination.
Coming up, good news from vaccine trials carried out in the UK this week. It may come as a surprise to some that we are reopening quite slowly when we've been hearing for weeks about how successful our vaccine rollout is here in the UK. How many people have we currently vaccinated? And what is the government's vaccination timetable at the moment?
In the UK at the moment, nearly 18 million people have had at least one dose of a COVID jab, and about 620,000 people have had their second dose. So this is a high proportion of the population. And I believe that the government has a target to offer all adults in the UK the jab by the end of July. So, I mean, that is fantastic news.
That is amazing. And there's also been data released this week which shows how much these vaccines can protect us. What did that tell us?
Well, so just to back up a bit here, we had data from clinical trials, and these are very controlled conditions because you really want to see exactly what the vaccines are capable of. But there's a difference between that and what happens in the real world. And really, it's what happens in the real world that everyone's been kind of watching and waiting and wanting to see what happens. Because, you know, fundamentally, that's real life. We want to see what happens in real life, not just in a very carefully controlled trial. And so there have been several studies looking at this, and the first data is really coming through now. And I have to say, it's very, very good news. There's a study in England called the Siren Study, and that looks at healthcare workers. So as you're probably aware, healthcare workers were one of the first groups to be offered the vaccine for obvious reasons. And this was looking at healthcare workers under 65. And this study, the results just come out that one dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine reduced the risk of them catching the virus by 70%. And it went up to 85% after the second dose. So this isn't just about them having symptoms. This is about them catching the virus at all. And we know that if you have less chance of catching the virus, it means you've got less chance of passing it on. So this isn't 100%. It's not going to stop everyone from getting the virus, but it is going to, you know, dramatically reduce it. Another study, this was done in Scotland, and this looked at sort of both the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine together. It didn't separate them out by the vaccine type, but it found that 4 weeks after receiving the first dose, the risk of hospital admissions from COVID had fallen by, I think it was up to 85% for the Pfizer vaccine and 94% for the AstraZeneca vaccine.
And that is incredibly positive news. But one thing I've been thinking about is how people who've been vaccinated might take that information. And as we go through the next few months where things are opening up quite slowly, you know, is there a risk that they could feel quite invincible once they've had the jab and perhaps not follow the rules because they think they're safe?
Well, I think there is a slightly difficult message here to get across, which, it's understandable why people might feel like that, but it's important to remember that despite the fact that a lot of people are getting the jab now, none of the vaccines are 100% effective. So even if you've had the jab, there is still a risk that you could catch COVID, and there's still a risk, although greatly reduced, that you could get sick. But it's also worth remembering that a large proportion of the population have not had a COVID vaccine. And in fact, even when everyone's been offered a jab, there'll be people who, for various reasons, including medical reasons, won't be able to have the vaccine or won't take the vaccine. And that means that you could still have very large numbers of people, even if the proportion is small, who are vulnerable and at risk from coronavirus. And that's one of the reasons why this unlocking is going slowly. And you've got to remember that, yes, a lot of the deaths are focused among groups that have now been offered the vaccine, but you've got a lot of people in hospital who are in younger age groups who are not necessarily got underlying health conditions or particularly vulnerable. So it's not just about deaths, it's also about hospitalizations. And it's also about remembering that the sooner you unlock, the larger the pool of people who won't yet have had the vaccine. And therefore, you run the risk again of having a big rise in hospitalizations and indeed of deaths. But the other thing is that we want to keep infections down for other reasons. So, for example, think about variants. Now, we know that the bigger the pool of infections, the greater the chance of new variants cropping up. You've just got sort of a bigger pool in which this can happen. So you want to keep infection numbers down so that you don't have such a big pool. You don't have the same kind of opportunities for new variants to crop up. And the other thing is that you want infections to get down to a very low level so that interventions like test, trace and isolate system can actually work. It's very hard to run those kinds of systems when you have huge numbers of infections. You need to get it down to small numbers so that those kinds of interventions can actually be as effective as possible.
Right, and we're not there yet, are we? Daily infections are still high, more than 10,000 a day, and yet we are now looking to begin lifting restrictions again. Is that something to worry about?
infections are still common. COVID is still very, very much here. If you look at numbers of people in hospital with COVID, we've only recently dropped below the peak of the first wave. So we're not in a fantastic position in terms of the infections and hospitalizations and deaths. We are still in a difficult position. And I think that, you know, we should be optimistic. Vaccines are going to make a big difference. There is a way to unlock the country, but we will see more deaths from coronavirus. And we need to take very, very great care in the steps ahead.
Nicola, finally, we've spent nearly a year now coming in and out of lockdowns, talking about different kinds of restrictions, having the government open things and close things. And all the way through, Boris Johnson has talked about following the science. Do you feel this week that he is finally doing that?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the phrase following the science, it's a nice phrase, but it's problematic. As the scientists themselves have always said, they can show the data and they can present the science, but when politicians make decisions, it has to take into account other factors as well. I mean, I think that the roadmap that's been set out, there's some detail lacking, but I think the fact that things are going relatively slowly and that there are these sort of 5-week intervals in the plan is good news. And I think that it's important that we do take things very slowly and take stock as we start to unlock and see, okay, how are things going? And is it actually safe to move on to the next stage?
Nicola, thank you very much.
It's lovely to be on. Thank you.
That was Nicola Davis. Read her analysis of the government's announcement at theguardian.com, where you can also keep up with the latest COVID developments via the live blog and find the full list of what is meant to change when over the next few months. And if you, like me, have been gripped by our freshwater series over the past 5 days, then I'm sure you are desperate for an update on the appeal. Anushka and Josh will bring you one when we know more. Keep up to date with the case at the website. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Attack and Rhys Storer, and sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.